The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Well, hi. I thought I'd start by telling you a little bit about how this book came into being. When I was a child, I told stories about my mother. And my friends were always saying, tell us another Mim tale. And they sort of took on this life of their own, these Mim tales. And I thought I would start by reading you one of my favorites. This is a true story. Imagine a New York City apartment at 6 in the morning. It's a modest apartment in Greenwich Village. Coffee is bubbling in an electric percolator. On the table is a basket of rye bread, an entire coffee cake, a few cheeses, a platter of cold cuts. My mother has been making breakfast, a major meal in our house, one where we sit down to fresh orange juice every morning, clink our glasses as if they held wine, and toast each other with, cheerio, have a nice day. Right now, she's the only one awake, but she's getting impatient for the day to begin, and she cranks WQXR up a little louder on the radio, hoping that the noise will rouse everyone else. But Dad and I are good sleepers, and when the sounds of martial music have no effect, she barges into the bedroom and shakes my father awake. Darling, she says, I need you. Get up and come into the kitchen. My father, a sweet and accommodating person, shuffles sleepily down the hall. He's wearing loose pajamas, and the strand of hair he combs over his bald spot stands straight up. He leans against the sink, holding onto it a little, and obediently opens his mouth when my mother says, try this. Later, when he told the story, he attempted to convey the awfulness of what she had given him. The first time, he said that it tasted like cat toes and rotted barley. But over the years, the descriptions got better. 2 years later, it had turned into pig snouts and mud. And 5 years later, he had refined the flavor into a mixture of antique anchovies and moldy chocolate. Whatever it tasted like, he said it was the worst thing he had ever had in his mouth. So terrible that it was impossible to swallow. So terrible that he leaned over and spit it into the sink and then grabbed the coffee pot, put the spout into his mouth, and tried to eradicate the flavor. My mother stood there watching all this. When my father finally put the coffee pot down, she smiled and said, just as I thought, spoiled. And here's another little Mim tale. What now, my father asked when he arrived home one day to find a tree being hauled up the side of our apartment building. He knew right away that it was destined for the 11th floor. Sure enough, my mother greeted him with the news that she had just purchased a dead birch tree to brighten up our home. Isn't it wonderful, she asked breathlessly, showing off an object that was at least twice as big as the available space. We can cut it down to size and hang seasonal decorations on it. Wonderful, he agreed, with the appropriate mixture of pride and skepticism. And such a bargain, she added. Dad wisely refrained from asking how much. They were always bargains, these things my mother dragged home from her peregrinations around New York City, or curiosities. Whenever my mother came upon some new food she had never seen before, she bought it. This meant that I was the first person in my class to taste mussels, cactus fruit, sea urchins, and lychee nuts. Mom was also a master of thinking up new uses for familiar foods. Once when I was driving back to college, she handed me a can of white asparagus, saying, take these for the road. You won't have to stop as often. They're very thirst-quenching. So I put these and many other Mim tales into my first book, Tender at the Bone. And later people started asking me, when did you find out that you were funny? And I said, I'm not funny. It had never occurred to me that these tales were really funny. They were just mom. But having realized that they were funny and revealing, I did have this uneasy feeling after the book was published, and I really hadn't meant to make public fun of mom. And I thought I owed her something. And I thought maybe I should write it, make it up to her by writing the book that she had always wanted to write. Mom had always wanted to write about her illness. She wanted to put down on paper for other people what it felt like to be manic depressive. And the problem is that the very fact that she had this illness meant that she was destined never to finish the book because she was incapable of finishing anything. And so now I thought that it was my duty to write that book for her. And I began doing research on bipolar disease. But while I was doing that, it came time for me to go into the studio and read the audiobook of Tender at the Bone. And reading an audiobook is a sort of addictive experience for a writer. This one was read at Carnegie Hall, and I went in there, and there I am in a booth with three people hanging on my every word, the perfect audience. And they had sort of counted that it would take 5 days to read this book, and I finished it in a little over three, and I came to the end, and they all looked up at me, and there was these six eyes sort of glaring at me going, that's it? You're leaving us here on the bridge? What happened next? And they made me take them out to lunch and tell them the rest of the story. And then they said, well, you have to write this down. This is great. And so I wrote the next book, and then after that I wrote the next book, and my mother's book is getting farther and farther away from me. And then it came time for me, last year I was given something called the Matrix Award, and they sent me a little disc and said, you know, we want you to write a 5-minute speech, and this is sort of what the speeches are like. And I kept thinking, I've got to write this speech. And I kept putting it off. And then one day I looked at the date, and I realized that the speech would be on what would have been my mother's 100th birthday. And so really without thinking, I sat down and wrote, this would have been my mother's 100th birthday. And then I did this thing that happens to you sometimes if you're very, very lucky as a writer, where you just vanish. And the words happen on the page, but you're not even conscious of what you're writing. And so I finished the speech, and I looked down, and it seemed pretty good to me. And I put it away and didn't think about it again until I was sitting up on this dais with 12 other women who are getting this award, and I'm one of the last people, and they're all getting up and saying, you know, I'm here because my mother was so wonderful. And I look down at what I've written, and I realize that this may not be such a great idea, but it's a little too late for me to do anything about it. So I get up and say, you know, I've been thinking about my mother and all the ways she made me into the person that I am. You know, she didn't do it in any of the ordinary ways. She wasn't a great writer or a great businesswoman, or even, if truth be told, a particularly good mother. I think she tried to be a good wife, but she wasn't much at keeping house, and I don't think I've ever met anyone who was a worse cook. But then I said those words. But my mother was a great example of everything I didn't want to be. And to this day, I wake up every morning grateful that I'm not her. And there was this, I mean, this is at the Waldorf Astoria. There were 1,500 people there. And there was one collective And a friend of mine who was there said, I was trying to figure out where you were going with this, and it didn't sound good. But I talked about how my mother and all these women of her generation had such high hopes for, they were the first generation of emancipated women, and they were educated, many of them, and they just went off into life with this notion of what a new woman could be, and then it just got dashed, and that my mother and so many of her friends were not allowed to work. And I talked about how, you know, that these women were smart, educated, and bored, and that even keeping house in the 50s, something that had been a real serious job for most of history, something that was backbreaking work that took all day, suddenly even that wasn't really enough to occupy an energetic person. And I said, you know, I've just never known so many unhappy people. And then I contrasted that with my father, who adored his work, and who I watched him leave the house every morning, just eager to go to this place where I didn't know exactly what happened in this secret place, but I knew that whatever it was, he came home happy every night. And he brought a briefcase, and he was even happy to open the briefcase and go into that briefcase and go back and disappear from us once again. And every morning when he left, I would just wish that my mother had her own secret place to go to. And I just thought she would be so much happier. And so I determined when I was very small that nobody was ever going to keep me from working. And I finished this speech by saying, and so when people ask, why do you work so hard? I say, because I can. So I finished this speech, and there's this sort of stunned silence in the room. And then I go back up and I look, and Christiane Amanpour was one of the people there, and she just came up to me and said, she was crying, and she said, you know, this is my mother's life that you just talked about. And I went into the ladies' room, and there were 10 women in there weeping, talking, saying, you know, this is my mother's life. And over the next few weeks, I started getting emails from people I didn't know. And they all began by saying, my mother was just like yours. An editor wrote to say that her mother was a neurologist who left her job to go home and raise 4 children. She was totally miserable. Another woman wrote to say that her mother had been a reporter before she gave up her work to raise 5 daughters. She was never happy about that decision, she said, and she insisted that every one of us go to college and have a career. A television producer wrote to say that her immigrant mother was brilliant, but with no real outlets, had spent her life frustrated and angry. And my producer wrote me from Los Angeles to tell me about her grandmother, who was a talented writer, quote, who spent her life playing bridge, gossiping, getting her hair done, and generally making her children miserable. And I realized that there were all these women who had been artists and businesswomen and doctors and lawyers who had given up their dreams to become a housewife, raise a family, and they did it only because it was what was expected of them. And listening to all these stories made me want to know how it felt to belong to that first generation of emancipated women. What was possible for them? What were their hopes for their daughters? And I began to think that I should turn this speech into a book. And I sort of thought it would be a kind of greatest generation for women. I knew one thing from the get-go, that this book was not supposed to be about me or my mother. I immediately began interviewing other women, and I wanted it to be universal. And there was great material there. And I loved doing these interviews. And then I went to the library and I started doing research into the 19th Amendment and what it meant to the women of my mother's generation. And it wasn't exactly what I had expected. I mean, it turns out that within 10 years, suffragette Ann Martin was saying that women in politics were, quote, exactly where men political leaders wanted them, bound, gagged, divided, and delivered to the Republican and Democratic parties. My favorite clipping was one I found whose headline read, "Women's Suffrage Declared a Failure." And the suffragette Ann Howard Shaw wrote in 1920, "I'm so sorry for you young women who have to carry on the work for the next 10 years. For suffrage was a symbol, and you've lost your symbol. There is nothing for women to rally around." And that proved really prophetic. So I gather all this material, and I've got mountains of it, and I go into my studio, and I try to wrestle this into some kind of a book. And I've never had so much trouble writing. I just sat there day after day after day with no idea with what to do with this massive amount of material. And finally it occurred to me that I ought to begin by finding out something about my own mother. So I went down into the basement and went looking for my mother's letters and diaries. There was a mountain of them. My mother came from a family that wrote letters to each other even when they were in the same town. So there are, you know, letters when you wouldn't expect them. She wrote notes to herself. She wrote little stories, and she kept everything from shopping lists to medical prescriptions. And what emerged was a really fascinating portrait of a woman who started out with enormous intelligence and great hope. One admirer wrote to her when she was in her early 20s, "No one around you can be half as strong as you. Go ahead into life, full-blooded, courageous, and leap for the adventure. But you must do it soon, before the summer of your youth has cooled off into caution. You are magnificently charming, and you come like a torrent. But you will be spent on the futility of little things. You are not a watercolor. You are carved out of life, and there can be no petty hesitancies about you." And of course, the sad thing was that my mother didn't leap for the adventure, and she was spent on the futility of little things. Reading through all of this, I saw what I should have known all along, which was that the book had to be about Mom. And I realized that if I could let her tell the story instead of trying to make it about everyone else, that she would be much more eloquent about her own generation than I ever could have been, and that in the particular we would get the universal. And so for months I sifted through documents. It was really heartbreaking work. I found, for instance, this very hopeful letter from my father early in their courtship. "The wonderful thing about a couple like you and me is that we give strength to each other in equal measure. We give each other strength for passion and strength for kindness, strength for decision, for patience, strength for company with others, and strength for utter seclusion together. That is what nature intended when she created all of us, male and female. Not the painful weakening you find as a result of most marriages. We complement each other and form one whole like a difficult jigsaw puzzle. It does not happen often in this age." It was so hard reading this and knowing what actually happened in their marriage, that they struggled terribly while my mother ended up careerless, miserably unhappy, and in the end spending an awful lot of time with psychiatrists. And yet, through all of that, what I also discovered is that she kept a very strong vision of what life might be, for a girl, for a woman. And she did her very best to make sure that my life would not turn out like hers. her troubled relationship with her own mother was surely mirrored throughout America in the years just after the war. Older women who had been trained to be docile helpmeets, to rely on their husbands, must have found their daughters' insistence on independence very worrisome. My grandmother once wrote to my mother, "You aren't grateful enough." And she was surely echoing the feelings of so many women of that generation who just couldn't understand their daughter's desire for a bigger life. Why couldn't they just accept what they had? These women struggled, but they shared a kind of quiet heroism that went unrecognized, even by them. Their lives were so much harder than they knew. They expected so much from the 20th century, and in the end, they got so little. I just think it's so sad that they didn't understand that they were pioneers and that they were walking into uncharted territory. There were no rules for them. Their mothers, who were raised in such different circumstances, couldn't show them what to do. And so the women of my mother's generation were forced to make it all up as they went along. People like my mother dared to imagine a world that was entirely different from the one in which they lived, and then they passed it on. If they had been complacent about their lives, my life and the life of my entire generation would have been completely different. If they hadn't had such a deep sense of failure, we would have been willing to accept less. It was their unhappiness that propelled us forward. And so now I know when I wake up in the morning, grateful not to be my mother, that that's exactly what she wanted me to feel. And I know something else. In that speech I gave, the one that turned into this book, I began by saying that Mom was, quote, not even a particularly good mother. I was dead wrong.
Okay, so
I'm sure you have a lot of questions, and I'm sure most of you know how this works. If you would raise your hands, I'll call on you, and we'll get a mic to you right here in front.
Did she know she had shortcomings, or did she think she was a gourmet?
My mother thought she was a great cook, and my father colluded in this by... My father was very loyal, and he, you know, said over and over, "Your mother is a wonderful cook." And he also, I mean, he was a German gentleman, and every night after dinner, he took her hand, kissed it, and thanked her for a wonderful meal. And she did think that she was a great cook, her meals were I cannot describe how truly dreadful they were. She was curious, which was not, I mean, she really did, you know, literally anything she didn't recognize, she brought home. And a friend of my brother's recently called me. He was talking about something else, but he said, "You know, I just want to tell you that your mother did feed me the single worst meal I've ever had in my life." And I said, "What was it?" And he said, "It was duck with chocolate sauce." And I think she just, and he said, "And on top of that, the duck was almost raw. And I think she just poured Hershey's syrup over it." See, I can't stop telling Mim tales.
It was mole. Another question. Right here in front in the purple.
Do you have any daughters?
I don't.
And what's your relationship like? Oh,
I have only a son. I'm sure that my relationship with my son is very different than it would be if I had a daughter. I hope that I would have been as generous as my mother was with me. I'm truly stunned. I mean, when I go through her notes and I see, you know, the many, many ways in which she really tried. I mean, the things that had blighted her. I mean, the hardest letter in the book is the first one, which the the earliest one, which was my grandfather wrote it to my mother when she was 16, and he said to her, "You are a dear girl and you have a fine mind, but you will have to accept the fact that you are homely and finding a husband will be difficult." And my mother carried this homely notion of herself. And if you look at the cover of the book, she was not a homely woman, but she was not conventionally attractive. And I think as a teenager, she was probably gawky and everything was too big. But when I was born, there's a note where she wrote, "No matter what this little girl looks like, I am going to do my best to make her feel pretty." And she was generous in so many ways, having been pushed into marriage. And one of the things that the themes of my grandmother's letters is my mother is like she came back to Cleveland and opened a bookstore and she was 20 and then she's 22 and then she's 25 and she doesn't have any beaus. And my grandmother keeps writing, "How I pray that you will find a man." And every, you know, "There was a full moon last night and I prayed for Mr. Wright." And this pressure, get married, get married, get married. She was very clear with me. You don't have to get married if you don't want to. She's just endlessly generous. And I hope that I would have been the same with my daughter.
Right here.
Can you talk a little bit about the process you went through from the relative anonymity of being a restaurant reviewer to exposing pretty much all parts of your life in your memoirs?
A restaurant critic isn't that anonymous. I mean, even though people don't know what you look like, I feel like one of the reasons that restaurant critics are so important to the life of a city is that they're a way for the paper to have a personality for people. And when I was at the LA Times, I the first time I went on jury duty, you know, when my name came out, the first thing they asked me in voir dire was something about my husband, who I had made into this character called the Reluctant Gourmet. And so, you know, even though you're not known, nobody knows what you look like, you feel very, or I did anyway. I mean, one of my feelings as a restaurant critic was that people should know who you are, that you should not be anonymous. They should get to know your taste, so even if they don't agree with you, they know they have something to bounce against. And, you know, as I said in Tender at the Bone, I've always thought that privacy was overrated. And I have a very deeply held belief that, you know, under the surface, we're remarkably similar, all of us, and that the reason to write a memoir is to sort of say, you know, I'm like you. I mean, to expose, I mean, I think that we're all filled with enormous self-doubt, and that even the most confident-seeming person, you know, wakes up in the morning trembling about all the things they're going to, all the mistakes they're likely to make during the day. And that I think that's important for other people to know.
Another question right in front here. Would you wait for the mic?
I have a two-parter for you. My friend and I each pronounce your last name differently. Could you settle it once and for all and
tell
us?
Well, I don't say it right either because my father said it beautifully because he was German, but I say Reichel.
She says Reichel and I say Reichel.
Yeah, well, she's I think right. My father, yeah, at least for me.
And the other question I have is, was your mother not able to benefit from pharmaceuticals or drugs to help her bipolar?
My mother was one of the very first people ever to take lithium. She took it long before it was approved by the FDA. She took ups, she took downs. She saw, I would safely say, every psychopharmacologist in New York had my mother as a patient at one point. they didn't do a whole lot for her. The lithium made sure that the most extreme manias stopped, but they were never able to deal with her depressions. Actually, for me, some of the truly most poignant letters are these letters she wrote to her various psychiatrists, which are in the book, and which I wanted to kill this man. I heard his name was Dr. Portnoy, which is so perfect. For years, you know, Dr. Portnoy says this, Dr. Portnoy says that. But then you read these letters my mother wrote to him, and I don't know if she ever sent them or if these are drafts that she then, you know, typed up a new version and sent them. But the way this man treated her is appalling, just appalling. And I assume that that's the way women were treated by medical profession in the 50s and 60s. And one of the most poignant things is, I mean, if this guy were still alive, I would go, I mean, he's just awful. But one of the really poignant things is when my mother finally goes to see a psychopharmacologist, even though he wasn't able to help her, she said, just knowing that it wasn't her fault, not having some analyst saying to her, you're doing this because you hate your mother, or whatever, you could get better if you wanted to. That's one of the things he kept saying to her over and over again. You could get better if you really wanted to. Other people get better. Why don't you? And that the relief of going to someone who said to her, this is not your fault. This is chemical. You can't control this, was all by itself enough to make her feel enormously better. And she valiantly tried everything. I mean, I found prescriptions for, you know, Elavil, Farazine. I mean, I got them all. I don't think there's a drug she didn't take.
Next question. Here in the orange.
At your last supper, who would you be dining with and what would you be eating?
Are these people alive, or I can have dinner with anybody I want? Well, I have to say that, of course, my family would be there. All of them resurrected, my mother, my father, and all my living relatives. I would also really like to have the first Queen Elizabeth, who absolutely fascinates me. I think she's one of the most interesting women who ever lived, and I would love to have a chance to talk to her. I would love to have Bertrand Russell there. He actually asked my mother to marry him at one point, and she took me to meet him when I was 12, I think. And I didn't know enough to ask him the right questions, but I would love to have another chance to ask him. What I would eat. You know, every time someone asks me this question, it changes. You know, it changes day to day because there's so many foods that I really love. Today, what I would eat, I probably shouldn't admit this, but I would start with a big pile of good caviar because I don't eat it anymore and I really miss it. and then I would have some clams on the half shell, which I also really love, and then some really good sea urchins still in the shell with just a squirt of lemon. And then I might have a great steak bone, just a wonderful, really well-aged steak bone, and some tomatoes just off the vine, just sliced, with a little bit of good olive oil and vinegar on it. And maybe some homemade fettuccine with just some really good butter on it and some Parmigiano. And then for dessert,
I would have one perfect peach. And of course, I would have some really good wines with all of this, too.
Right in front here, and then the lady in the blue.
Where did you or where are you going to eat dinner tonight? And the other part of my question is, what is your favorite hole-in-the-wall restaurant in New York City? Because that's where I live.
Well, I don't know if you would call this a hole-in-the-wall, but my favorite place to eat in New York City is Momofuku Sambar. I just love that food. It's not exactly a hole-in-the-wall, but it's, you know, they don't take reservations and it's really loud. Momofuku Sambar. It's David Chang, who is this enormously talented young Korean-American chef, and he makes completely wild and wonderful food. I mean, one of the things that he makes is whipped tofu with sea urchin and tapioca in it, and it's just amazing. It does this textural dance in your mouth, and the flavors are great. And he also had this idea of freezing foie gras and shaving it, and so it comes together in your mouth in this magical way. And then he does some really traditional Korean things, really spicy broccoli and rice sticks and chilies. Now, where I'm eating here, I'm probably having room service in my hotel. It's been a long day.
Lady here in the blue.
I'm just curious if you, Ruth, would call yourself a feminist, and if so, what you would say to young women sort of with the perspective of having just completed this book.
Yeah, I'm definitely a feminist, although probably not, you know, not a militant marching feminist, but, you know, one of the things, it took me a long time in the 60s to understand that I too had a cause. You know, I mean, after doing all the civil rights stuff, I sort of thought, you know, where's my cause? And then I realized, you know, oh my God, it's women. And I feel like there is so much work to be done today. I think in many ways we've gone backwards. And I think the big fight is on a macro level. I mean, I think that we need to be a country that deals with the fact that men and women both work, and they ought to be sharing all of the family burdens, and businesses and government ought to make things easier for women. It is just, you know, every time some young woman on my staff gets pregnant, you know, I end up saying to them, you know, now you're going to understand what real guilt is, because there is nothing like having a child and working, and no matter what you do, you feel, if you're at work, you feel that you should be home, and if you're home, you feel that you should be at work. And that feeling doesn't go away. And I think it's something that we have to solve on. I mean, this isn't something any one individual can figure out for herself. It's something, I mean, we have to figure out better childcare, and we have to raise men to understand that parenting is a two-person job, and that, you know, a father can be just as effective as a mother. And one of the, for me, really poignant things about this book is I had dinner on Saturday night with a 40-year-old friend who said, I think I'm just like your mother. She said, you know, she's a woman who had a huge job, and she has two children, and she opted to give up her job and be a stay-at-home mom. And she said, I wish I didn't resent it every day, but I really do. And while I was here this afternoon, I spent some time with my niece, who's a graduate student here, who has two little children. And, you know, she didn't work this year so she could know, she gave up this year to take care of her kids. And she said, I really try and be nice to my husband when he comes home, but I resent the fact that he gets to skip out every day. And we need to change that.
Time for a few, a lot of hands. Gentleman right in here.
You seem to paint a pretty bleak picture of your mother's inner life, so I have one and then a second question. Question one, was she really happy about anything? And second of all, do you see any of your mother in yourself?
I'll answer the first question first, because for me, one of the really joyful things about going through all of her letters is that at the very end of her life, she was very happy. She, after my father died, she basically went to bed for 4 years and did nothing. And then, for whatever reason, she rose up and said, this is all I've got. And it's very poignant because she writes to herself, my mother has been dead for 25 years. Why am I still caring about what she thinks? And she finally throws it off and she realizes she can't be a doctor anymore, but she has a sick friend and she invites her to come live with her and she takes care of her. And then she opens up her house and she has students living with her and she starts traveling with Elder Hostel. And she was very gregarious, and she, you know, would go out in the street and meet people in the park and bring them home for dinner. And she led a very unconventional life, but she found herself. And she was very, very happy as an older woman alone. And she was amazingly drug-free. I sort of describe it as she was like that place we would all like to be right after you've had one sip of a martini, you know, just that little bit of, and she was like that for the last years of her life. And, for me, there are many lessons in that, but, you know, one of them is that it's never too late. It doesn't matter how old you are, you can still find happiness. And I got a call. I got an email from someone who had read the book and said, I was one of those people that your mother adopted, and she was like a magical person to me. She said, I didn't get along with my own parents, and your mother took me in, and she was, you know, I'd never seen a grown-up dressed like that. She was wearing red linen dresses and bangles, and she'd take me to museums and show me how to like the art, and she'd take me out to eat, and she'd say, have anything you want, have as much as you want. She was pretty happy, interestingly, in her most independent years. She was happy when she had the bookstore. She was happy in the years between her marriages, and she was happy as an old woman alone. Do I see anything of myself and my mother? No.
Some questions all the way in back, and lady all the way on our right.
I was just wondering, I know you had a really interesting start to your food writing career and sort of just the general path that you took. I was wondering if you have any advice for someone today who's trying to start off on that type of path and really would love nothing more than to be a food writer.
The big secret about food writers is that there are very few good ones. I mean, even many of the famous ones, if you see their raw copy, they're not that good. So it is a field that has a lot of opportunity for people. We are a culture that is increasingly interested in food, so we are looking for more and more food writing, and it's not something that people naturally do well. I mean, one of the big mistakes of food writing is people think, you know, food is so seductive that it all by itself is enough to make it interesting, and that's not true. And, you know, my advice would be, one, just start off by trying to describe to yourself everything that you eat. Just describe the flavors to yourself over and over again, trying not to use terms like delicious. I mean, you know, try and make word pictures for yourself of what those foods, how they make you feel. Read as many good writers as you can, not just food writers, but writers. I mean, it's the writing that matters, not the food. You know, I started out by writing for throwaway papers for free. I couldn't afford to go to real restaurants, or expensive restaurants, but I went to little, you know, food carts and things like that and wrote about them and for free for a newspaper, and then I had clippings, and it's a start.
Some more questions. Do you want to just pick that gentleman, lady? I can't see.
Your books are the ones that I can read and reread and laugh as hard as when I first read them. I just wanted to add a point that your memoir tonight has meant a great deal to me. I'm a daughter that has 101-year-old mother, and she started a business in 1929 because of the need of her sister, a dress store around Rittenhouse Square. And she worked so she didn't have to cook. And I'm very grateful for that. But being a Virgo and liking things to match, her favorite chocolate cocoa cake had an interior chocolate cake with a matching icing.
Couple on this side, all the way back.
Did you ever cook for your mother, and what was that like?
Oh, I cooked for my mother all the time. I mean, I started cooking for my mother when I was about 6. She was the easiest person on earth to cook for. She was taste blind, so she really didn't care about food. It just didn't interest her very much except intellectually. And so if you could cook her something that, you know, I mean, she would, for instance, you know, bring home cactus fruit and say, you know, here, why don't you just do something with that? And no matter what you did with it, she'd be happy. So she was a very easy audience.
I'm wondering if you could describe your biggest cooking disaster. And then I'd also like to hear about your most inconvenient craving and the quest that went with that food craving.
Whoa. Inconvenient craving. I will tell you, I guess, my biggest cooking disaster. When I was 21, I wrote a cookbook called and that was a disaster all by itself. Somebody should have said, people are going to be embarrassed to go into a store and say, do you have Needless to say, it was not a giant seller. My editor, I thought we should invite my editor for dinner. And we lived on the Lower East Side at a time when the Lower East Side was pretty scary. We lived on a walk-up, sort of illegal artist loft walk-up on a street that was both dangerous and filled with a combination of drug addicts and Bowery bums. And so my very proper editor arrives at our house for dinner, and I've been so nervous about this meal because, I mean, she didn't really know if I could cook or not, and I had to show her that I could cook. I mean, she'd already signed the contract, but I still thought she might be a little nervous about it. So I did that thing that very young cooks do, which is I cooked a meal of nothing but punctuation marks. I mean, every single thing was a tour de force. And sort of, you know, halfway through the cooking, I realized that I should have had a couple of simple things that, you know, this food didn't really go together all that well. It was just one bang, 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 bang. And on top of that, by the time we sat down to dinner, I had been cooking for days, and I'd made all these complicated things. And I guess the food was okay, but I was so nervous that I quickly drank way too much wine. And about halfway through dinner, I just fell face forward into my plate. It was awful. I don't think of cooking. You know, if you make a bad meal, so what? It's just a meal. So when you say cooking disasters, I'm sure I've had many of them. You know, things I overcooked, oversalted. They don't resonate with me that much because, you know, I think if people come to your house, they're happy for the company. They're happy that you tried it. And if it's not the best thing they ever ate, so what? Then you invite them back and make something really spectacular the next time. I'm trying to think of a culinary quest that sent me off in search of... it's actually an ongoing culinary quest. When I was first married the first time, we turned in all of our wedding presents so we could get enough money to go to Europe. And went to Europe for 6 months. That was when you could live in Europe on $3 a day, and we had rail passes and we were sleeping on trains, and somehow in the course of this we ended up in Tours, in the middle of France, and Doug took a bunch of pictures of me with the most spectacular brioche I've ever eaten. I mean, it was fabulous, and there are these pictures of me with the brioche, and gradually it's coming down. And every couple of years, I go to Tours and start looking for this pastry shop where we bought this, and I have never found either the pastry shop or a brioche that... And you have to understand, I once had a cat named Brioche, so it means a lot to me. And I have never found another one to equal that one.
And folks, that's where we have to leave it. Ruth Reichel. Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.